Hello, this is Issa Kahn with The Long View, a show that features interviews with very interesting and knowledgeable guests, I promise. Our program lets you know about what's happening in the natural environment in real time and features information about green jobs and technology that we hope inspires you weekly. For more information about The Long View and its guests, please visit thelongview.org. Today's guest is Deborah Kramer, author of Smithsonian Ocean, Our Water, Our World. I'm so pleased that she can join us for the Longview's kickoff after a long hiatus. Deborah lives with her family at the edge of a salt marsh in Gloucester, Massachusetts, and she writes about science, nature, and the environment. She was awarded the Science Writing Fellowship at the Dibner Institute for the History of Science and Technology at MIT in 2005 and 2006. She's currently a visiting scholar at MIT's Earth System Initiative. Welcome, Deborah.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Please tell us more about yourself. What kind of background led you to write about the ocean?
I think the most important part of my background that led me to write about the ocean was a trip to Cape Cod when I took with my family when I was 12 years old. I'd never been to see the ocean before. I'd never been swimming in salt water. We had a vacation for about a week, and I loved it. It never occurred to me, obviously, when I was 12 years old, that I would write about the sea, but I think I held that memory all the way through high school, all the way through college.
Oh, that's fascinating. And now you're in Gloucester, and within proximity of smelling the ocean, I think, right?
Right. I live right on the edge of a salt marsh.
Yeah. Oh, that's lovely. Well, what should we know, some basics about the ocean worldwide? Can you tell us about, well, its size, the large and small ecosystems that make up that whole, and something about that interdependence of those ecosystems?
I think the most important thing to think about when you think about the ocean is that while we live on dry land, dry land is basically a few islands in water, and that while we call this planet Earth, it's really planet ocean.
Yeah.
There's twice as much water on the surface as there is land. And if you think about it by volume, you could take all the continents and stuff it into 10% of the ocean.
So, now, I know that there are different ecosystems that, you know, some of them are very deep out in the ocean, some run along the marshes and such. How many ecosystems are there? Is there a number to that, or is
I can't really say that there's a number. I think the most important thing to think about when you think about the whole variety is that they're all connected. So there's all the cold water polar ecosystems way up in the tropics, and then coral ecosystems down. There's the polar ecosystems way up in the Arctic and Antarctica, and the tropic ecosystems with coral reefs, temperate ecosystems like off the coast of New England, where there's some of the most fertile ocean water in the world. The most important thing about all of these is that they're all connected, and the health of one is connected to the health of another. Similarly, what's going on in the ocean is very connected to what's on land. And I like to think about these abstract concepts concretely by thinking about when I was in Savannah, Georgia, a few years ago, walking on a beach, I picked up a beautiful sea bean and a beautiful sea heart. These were seeds from the tropical forest in South America.
Yeah.
They had flowed down the Amazon and gotten into the currents and washed up on the beaches of Savannah. And similarly, all the water is connected. So while we think about fresh water on land, all of that water actually comes from the ocean. So you can have salt water way, way out in the Pacific that evaporates and is blown in on wind and creates something like the Olympic National Rainforest.
Right. Oh, that's fascinating. So, well, We'll talk about this in a few minutes, but so I'm going to understand that there might be some effects of, for example, the oil spill in the Gulf. If what you're saying is true, of course it is. So let's talk about that a little bit in a few minutes. But before we do, what have we done as humans? What have we done to the oceans over the millennia, please? So what sort of human behaviors have escalated some of the damage that we have heard about?
When I think about what we've done to the ocean, it really hasn't been over millennia. It's been over a much shorter period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the biggest things would be we've taken out an awful lot of really big fish. So we've restructured ocean ecosystems by taking out a lot of the top predators, leaving us the main top predator that's left.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, we've changed the chemistry of the ocean by putting so much nitrogen in from agricultural runoff, from cars, from power plants. Our contribution to nitrogen is equal to the natural contribution.
Right.
That has totally changed the chemistry of our estuaries.
Right, right.
And then the third thing would be fossil fuel emissions are also changing the temperature of the ocean and the chemistry of the ocean by making the water more acidic.
Right.
So those would be the really, really big changes.
Now, I know something about, for example, fertilizer on the edge of natural waterways, probably ocean water as well, salt water as well. It has the effect of that is that the vegetation then grows very lushly. This runoff from fertilizer creates this lush vegetation on the water edges. The vegetation falls in. It, you know, might
decomposes.
Yeah, decomposes, and these have.
It uses up oxygen,
mm-hmm.
and creates areas in coastal estuaries where there isn't enough oxygen for animals to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
These kinds of circumstances didn't really occur very often 50 years ago in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were only a few. Now there are hundreds of them worldwide. The largest is in the Baltic, but now the United States has number two and number three. One, the dead zone in Louisiana, which occurs every summer off the coast of Louisiana. It's about the size of Massachusetts.
Hmm.
So,
oh, can you describe that, please, Deborah?
So every summer at the mouth of the Mississippi River, because it's mostly fertilizer and other nitrogen elements coming down the Mississippi River, go into the Gulf of Mexico. They act like a garden that's being over-fertilized. Phytoplankton bloom like crazy. They die. They decompose. As they decompose, oxygen is taken out of the water. So every summer, an area the size of Massachusetts along the bottom doesn't have enough oxygen to support animal life. So every fish that's there swims away, but every animal that can't swim away dies.
Ah, okay.
Now, if this were happening out in plain view
on the earth,
we would be dealing with it immediately.
Yeah.
But we can't see it.
Yeah.
So it's taken a lot longer. Now, like many of these very serious problems we face, we can fix all of them.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a lot of studies of the nitrogen inputs into the Mississippi River and what needs to be done to change this. And it requires rebuilding the wetlands,
mm-hmm.
along the edges of farm fields so that the fertilizer running off will go to support those lush grasses that you just mentioned. It requires rethinking the way we apply fertilizer. These are concrete things that are actually not that difficult to do.
Right, and we can't let the fertilizer run into the water.
Right.
It has to be contained and hopefully, from the Longview standpoint, organic as often as possible. Let's bring it back up to the Northeast for a second. Can we talk about the fishermen a little bit? I know that the fishermen are very upset. You know, their trade that they've depended on for years is diminishing. They're having to find other work. They're very upset about these restrictions on their fishing. What's been going on, for example, in Gloucester with the fishermen, and are the fishermen very responsible for the depletion of the fish?
It's hard to blame fishermen for the depletion of fish. It's been a combination of our not knowing how to manage fisheries, and then our choosing not to manage them, and then some groups of people deciding that managing isn't a really good thing. It's true that many of our most important New England fish stocks have been depleted.
Mm-hmm.
It's also true that under these stricter management plans, many of them are coming back.
Okay.
So haddock, for example, both on George's Bank and in the Gulf of Maine, is almost completely rebuilt.
Mm-hmm.
That's because fishermen have made substantial sacrifices in order for this to happen, and it's because the management is a lot tighter now and requires managers to listen to fisheries scientists who are really, really good at understanding this.
Right.
Similarly, in New Bedford, New Bedford is now the number one port on the eastern seaboard for value landed. That's because the scallop fishery has been totally rebuilt.
Hmm.
It was closed in, I believe, 1992 or 1994 for 6 years while the groundfish were being rebuilt. During that closure, scallops returned in densities and sizes larger than any living scientist had ever seen. These kinds of examples, I think, show that over the long term, these sacrifices are going to be well worth the difficulties that we're experiencing
right,
now.
Right.
It's also very important, though, to realize that we can't demand these sacrifices of fishermen without protecting the water in which they fish. The striper industry, for example, in Chesapeake Bay was at an all-time low. Fishermen there agreed to stop catching big stripers.
Mm-hmm.
And over a period of time, that fishery also came back. It was an incredible success story. But now, the stripers aren't doing very well for some of the reasons we just discussed. There's too much nitrogen in the water, which is creating a lack of oxygen. Also, the water is getting warmer because of global warming. And the fish aren't doing very well.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can't protect fish without protecting their habitat. And the scallop fishery may not do very well if the water becomes increasingly acidic, because scallop shells are made of calcium carbonate and acid water dissolves calcium carbonate.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So we have a responsibility. While we're asking fishermen to make sacrifices, we need to change the way we live on land in order to protect the water.
Right. And that's all of us. I mean, that's all of us that have gardens and lawns and farms and
heat our houses.
Yeah, and use petroleum-based products and
right.
all of this. Okay. Well, do you, you know, in your studies of the ocean and being in Gloucester with a lot of concerned fishermen, I'm just returning to the fishermen for a second, because part of my interest personally is finding environmentally safe alternatives for folks that find themselves out of work when you know, better environmental practices are called for. I mean, what can the fishermen do? What do you see as some of the alternative industries, maybe, for the fishermen or for ocean people who live by the ocean that are ocean specific?
Well, I don't actually see these jobs disappearing over the long haul.
Mm-hmm.
If we're able to rebuild these fish stocks, they should be able to support all of Gloucester's fishermen.
Oh, good.
And Gloucester has received an amazing amount of federal aid during this downturn, and the congressional delegation continues to apply for federal aid in order to tide people over until the stocks can be rebuilt. Sacrifices are required until they can be rebuilt, but I don't think anybody believes they can't be rebuilt.
Right. Oh, good. No, Deborah, you sound really helpful, and it's good to hear. Okay, now, we've got a couple more minutes, so I do want to go to this topic that has been burning for, well, the past few months, and still burning in my mind and other people I know, and that is, what about the Gulf? Now, after this catastrophe, with the oil spill from BP, what are we looking at currently at the damage? And from your research or people that you know, what can you tell us about our near and long-term future? And I'm sorry, that question was very long.
Well, I think it's important, though, to take the long view about when looking at this tragedy in the Gulf of Mexico. I think that we have all blamed BP for this disaster. And it is certainly true that BP was careless, and our regulation of those drilling operations has been neglectful. However, I think it's important to consider this in a context, which is that BP dumped 4.9 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico over a period of 3 months.
Million or billion? I forget.
Million.
Million, okay.
And the rest of us are burning four times that amount every day.
Wow.
So that is the context of this gusher. It's going to have short-term and long-term impacts. Much of the Louisiana fishing industry was shut down. This is $1 billion a year fishing industry. And when it is reopened, and large parts of it have been, it isn't fully recovered. And the oyster industry in Louisiana is going to take years to recover from this. If you go to places where the Bay of Campeche spill occurred in 1979, there are still places where you can dig into the sediment and it smells like freshly paved asphalt.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a 30-year
process of rejuvenation.
But the larger problem of changing the entire ocean by burning 20 million barrels every day, these consequences are actually much more long-term, mm-hmm. and consequently much more serious.
So I'd have to make a pitch for renewable energy, right?
Yes, absolutely. We need to reduce our fossil fuel emissions 80% by 2050.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're talking about major, major changes. We're talking about losing a lot of our fisheries because they won't be able to survive in the kind of water that we're going to be getting. We're talking about major sea level rise that's going to flood huge portions of our coastlines.
Yeah.
We're talking about drastic reductions in our ability to produce food and in our ability to get fresh water.
This is, yeah, thank you. Well, thank you for sharing this information.
But we can do this.
Yeah. No, you sound hopeful, and it's really a pleasure to have someone who's so knowledgeable to share this information, because I feel it's very authentic, and I feel that people need to know about this stuff. You have indicated to me, though, that there are researchers who have been purchased by, is it BP or otherwise?
I don't know the degree that is going on right now. At the beginning, it certainly was difficult because BP was saying that scientists who were looking at the long-term effects of the oil spill, who were getting money from BP, that the information was going to be proprietary. And the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration was also saying that.
Mm-hmm.
It is my understanding now that these gag orders have been lifted.
Right.
And so there are lots of scientists down there really looking hard at the long-term impacts. So when you asked about New England, one really important one is what happened to the bluefin tuna spawning.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be looking at that over the next 2 years.
Right. Okay, thank you. And by the way, you know, that particular question stems from actually hearing myself from some researchers or scientists that had said it was very difficult not to, you know, end up working for BP or BP's interests. Very hard, because they're very well-padded industry.
They have a lot of money, and we as a country, have not been committed to funding science research.
Yeah, and we ought to start doing that.
Yes.
Yes. Well, Deborah, let's please share with our listeners about this talk you're giving next week, November 15th at UMass Lowell. Do you have the details for that?
It's November 15th at 3 o'clock at UMass, and it's being sponsored by the Department of Work Environment, the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production, and the UMass Lowell Climate Initiative. And there, you asked about what we could do. This talk is a perfect representation of that, because it's several different departments with different points of view coming together to look collaboratively at a problem and to seek solutions locally.
Thank you so much. This is fascinating. For more information about Deborah Kramer, her book, and the Longview, please visit thelongview.org, and thanks for listening.